Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. A judge has ordered the city of Santee to void its approvals of Finita Ranch, a major housing development due to fire danger. A teenager locally has died of COVID-19. Find out the latest information on risk to young people from COVID on today's show. Monarch butterfly populations are plummeting, and a local event in Alpine aims to help them survive with information and milkweed plants you can plant at home. A major revitalization of the Casa de Oro community is in the works. Learn more on today's show. Then on People Power, hear about a veteran who's leading efforts to clean up Lemon Grove, removing tons of trash as well as graffiti. Major's Diner, a 50s-style eatery in Pine Valley, needs help to pay its bills after pandemic shutdowns. We'll tell you how you can help this 60-year-old business. The federal government is lifting Title 42 restrictions on immigrants that have been in place since the start of the pandemic as refugees from Ukraine arrive at our border. From California News Service, hear which produce items have the most and least pesticide residues. Then on Crime Beat, hear about changes in how officer-involved shootings will be investigated in our region. Next, we'll have news about new COVID-19 antibody studies. And then, hear about a wind energy company that's pled guilty to violating federal laws and killing 150 eagles, and why some local residents are concerned about the future of eagles at wind projects here in San Diego's East County. And finally, we'll be re-airing two of our Best of East County episodes today, taking you on the road to the Water Conservation Garden, followed by an interview with Roy Toft of Ramona, talking about his experiences as a National Geographic wildlife photographer. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters.
Finita Ranch, the 3,000-unit housing project that was approved by the city of Santee 2 years ago, has received another setback when a San Diego judge ruled that the city must rescind all legal permits for the construction. The judgment by Superior Court Judge Catherine Bacall, filed on April 6th, calls on the city to vacate a series of votes that gave Finita Ranch the green light back in September of 2020. Bacall faulted the city and its contracted experts for creating an inadequate environmental report about impacts from the project, especially the lack of safe evacuation routes in case of an emergency, such as a major wildfire. The judge was particularly critical of the city's removal of a key evacuation route, a proposed extension of Magnolia Avenue from the EIR. The judge wrote that a full assessment of alternate routes was lacking, and the city didn't provide adequate details about all the risks involved in these routes. She also said the report did not provide any investigation into the risk of injury or death for any residents who sheltered in place, as the city had suggested as a viable option. One of the alternative evacuation routes in the city's plan showed Mast Boulevard connected to State Route 67, but Judge Bacall noted that this route is non-existent because Mast Boulevard dead ends at a park. HomeFed Corporation, the developer of Finita Ranch, delayed the vote by the Santee City Council by several weeks when it removed a planned extension to Magnolia Avenue. At the time, HomeFed said it was doing so to avoid a possible conflict of interest involving a council member who owned property on the street. Judge Bacall's ruling was praised by the head of one of the four environmental groups that filed suit after the city council approved the project. Van Collinsworth of Preserve Wild Santee told East County Magazine, "Growing wildfire risks must not be ignored. The court's decision rightly requires the rising risks to be recognized." The other groups suing HomeFed and the city were the Center for Biological Diversity and Endangered Habitats League and the California Chaparral Institute. Jeff O'Connor, Vice President of Community Development for HomeFed Corporation, said in an email, "We are reviewing the court ruling and its impact on Finita Ranch. We are confident that this important project will proceed upon addressing the court ruling." O'Connor previously said that the ruling means the company must revise the environmental report, a process that would take 3 to 6 months before it's brought to the City Council again for public review. He also acknowledged that Finita Ranch will go to a public vote for Santee voters as a result of the passing of Measure N in 2020. That proposition requires any development that doesn't meet the current general plan to go to a vote of the people. But more recently, in January 2021, the council voted to place the Finita Ranch project on the November 8th ballot this year, after Preserve Wild Santee and other groups opposed the project gathered some 6,200 signatures, far more than necessary, to force the council to rescind its action or schedule a public vote. Mayor John Minto said the city likely won't appeal the judge's ruling, but wasn't sure what HomeFed would do. He noted they could withdraw the entire application, and if that happens, it takes everything off the table. Minto said the city would comply with rescinding the 2020 approvals. The Finita Ranch development has been in Santee's plans for decades and has gone through several changes. Prior to HomeFed's current plan, the city approved the building of 1,400 houses on the 2,600-acre site in 2007. HomeFed purchased the land out of bankruptcy in 2011, paying about $12 million. The development firm overhauled the design, creating a project that keeps about 76% of the site as open space, parks, a working farm, and a vineyard. In its outreach letter sent to most residents several years ago, HomeFed said fire safety is a priority and noted the construction involved extensive vegetation breaks and fire buffers, as well as ignition-resistant materials. HomeFed also promised to build a fire station on site, which lies directly in the path of the deadly 2003 Cedar Fire. As to the traffic problems resulting from the addition of about 8,000 new residents, the developers pledged to invest in improvements to State Route 52, including adding a westbound lane along with a high-capacity on-ramp at Mast Boulevard. HomeFed has said it would get those improvements done before allowing any new residents to move into their homes. But with the project stalled, those highway improvements are also postponed indefinitely. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Elijah McKee.
This is Kylie Dees with a health report. A 15-year-old girl has died from COVID-19. San Diego County's Health and Human Services Agency announced on April 13th. She was not vaccinated and had underlying medical conditions. The teen was the second person under age 18 to die of the disease locally. The first was a 10-year-old boy from East County who passed away in January. Dr. Wilma Wooten, the county's public health officer, says pediatric deaths are tragic, adding, "This unfortunate death reminds us that COVID-19 can impact anyone, regardless of age or gender, and we must do everything to protect ourselves and our loved ones." Death isn't the only risk that COVID-19 poses for children and teens, who are at risk for developing multisystem inflammatory syndrome in children, a rare but serious inflammatory condition associated with COVID-19. 96 cases have been reported in San Diego County since the pandemic began. County health officials continue to encourage everyone eligible to get vaccinated against COVID-19 to get all the recommended doses. In San Diego County, about 94% of those eligible age 5 and older have received at least one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine. About 84% of those 12 to 17 have gotten at least one dose, but only 43% of children ages 5 to 11 have been vaccinated. The California Department of Public Health is working to get children age 5 and up vaccinated against COVID-19 and will be bringing COVID-19 vaccinations to after-school programs, libraries, local parks, and other recreational areas. The county is also urging anyone eligible for booster shots to get boosted, and for those over age 50 or who are immune compromised, second booster shots are now available. Vaccinations are available at pharmacies, medical providers, clinics, and county locations. You can also make an appointment or find a site near you by calling 211.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Marie Johnson with the Green Scene Report. Would you like to be part of creating your own special garden where monarch butterflies can thrive? You're invited to learn more on Saturday, April 30th at 1 p.m. at the Alpine Town Hall, also known as the Alpine Women's Club Building. Milkweed is the only plant that the monarchs can lay their eggs on. Without milkweed, the monarchs cannot reproduce. In the past year, monarchs have declined by 90% due to pesticides and development. The speakers at the April 30th program will be Carlette Anderson, Director of Alpine's Community Wildlife Habitat Program, and John Green, former Director of the Backcountry Land Trust. Anderson says, "With your help, we can help the monarch butterflies lay their eggs in your garden." Milkweed plants will be available for purchase at the program. If you are unable to attend and would like to order milkweed plants, you can call John Green at 619-504-8181. That number again is 619-504-8181.
Could Casa de Oro become East County's version of the gas lamp or Little Italy? That may sound grandiose, but the county is planning a dramatic transformation of the Campo Road corridor through Casa de Oro in Spring Valley with a vision to create a Main Street ambience in the heart of the community. On April 22nd, the County Planning Commission will hold a hearing on the proposed Campo Road Revitalization Specific Plan, which covers 60 acres centered on Campo Road from Rogers Road to Granada Avenue. A central plaza for outdoor community activities, roundabouts, bike and pedestrian-friendly changes, trees, outdoor seating, new street parking, more retail shops, outdoor dining opportunities, and covered verandas for shoppers are all part of the revitalization plan. The plan would also allow up to four-story buildings to create housing with density bonuses, a dramatic change from the one- and two-story structures currently along Campo Road. The new construction would be made possible by allowing building closer to the street by using the 100-foot existing right-of-ways. Casa de Oro means House of Gold, but in recent years the area has been anything but golden. The community has struggled with run-down and vacant buildings, illegal marijuana dispensaries, crime problems, and a lack of community character. The plan also calls for creation of a large community gathering space where outdoor events and special programs can be held, a goal voiced by many residents in community meetings on the plan. A series of smaller open spaces will also be added to provide shade, seating, and rest areas for shoppers, dog walkers, parents with children, and others. New gateway signage is also planned to herald entry to the revitalized Casa de Oro community. If approved by planners and ultimately the County Board of Supervisors, the plan would be completed in three phases. The improvements could be funded through grants, government programs, creation of a planned business improvement district, and by attracting private investors. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Tidwell.
You're listening to the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
This is East County Magazine's People Power, profiling local people making a positive difference in our community and our world.
This is Elijah McKee with a People Power report. Joshua Klein, a U.S. Navy veteran, and his wife, Stephanie, became inspired to help their city, Lemon Grove. According to Klein, the couple and their team of volunteers have now picked up 1,250 gallon bags of trash along Broadway Avenue, as well as at freeway entrances and exits. In addition, the couple has painted over graffiti in more than 500 public spaces, says Klein, who provided photos of their work. Klein thanked the team of citizen volunteers who have helped out. After moving to Lemon Grove, Klein and his wife saw a need for community, as well as a lot of trash piled up on streets. So they joined forces to create the Lemon Grove Veterans Group and hosted a daily trash pickup event at the Big Lemon Statue. Their mission was to bring all types of people together to pick up trash, build community, and engage in meaningful relationships. Every branch of the military has been represented at their trash pickups. EDCO donated bags and a separate community dumpster for the volunteers. Soon, they were disposing of 10 50-gallon bags each day. Many volunteers were so inspired by these efforts that they created other volunteer groups, such as homeless outreach, business improvement meetings, graffiti abatement, rec center activities, and a community garden group. The daily trash pickup volunteers meet every morning at 5 a.m. and upon finishing, enjoy a cup of coffee together at The Hamlet, a local coffee shop. The Veterans Group has also created an Achieving Community Together, or ACT, tab to celebrate the community and offer a complimentary beverage to volunteers, police, fire, city workers, MTS, and any community member experiencing hardship. The Veterans Group can provide community service, youth development, and volunteer hours for those in need. They provide trash tongs, bags, gloves, and reflective gear. Interested volunteers can email lemongroveveteransgroup@gmail.com.
For more than 60 years, Major's Diner has been serving the Pine Valley community as a place to meet, grab coffee, and a hot meal. The diner's vintage 1950s decor features movie posters from James Dean, Betty Boop memorabilia, vintage records on the wall, and a classic car hood mounted above the serving counter. But now it's in danger of closing its doors permanently. At the start of the COVID-19 pandemic, the diner was forced to shut down temporarily, but was unable to get any government grants. Even when restaurants were allowed to reopen for outdoor dining, cold winter weather and even snow made this challenging for restaurants in San Diego's mountain towns, such as Pine Valley. That's left the owners with large bills from their landlord, SDG&E, and others. Since October, the owners have had a GoFundMe fundraiser up asking the community for help to pay their backlog of bills in hopes that the diner can continue serving fare ranging from cheeseburgers to cappuccinos. East County Magazine sat down with Debbie Rushing McNamara, who's been running the diner since 2005, the business's fourth owner since Major's Diner was established in 1961. She says when they shut everything down for COVID, we had no business at all. We were able to stay open for to-go, but we were doing $100 to $200 a day and having the same bills that we had before. Now, 8 months of past due bills must be paid. The GoFundMe page, titled Help for Major's Diner, set a goal to raise $40,000. But so far, less than $7,000 has been raised online, although a few people have stopped by the diner to donate in person. McNamara hopes the goal will be reached by summer. She says, when everything started going again, people came in. It was amazing that people came back, and they came from all over the county. Major's Diner is located on Old Highway 80 in the heart of Pine Valley. It's open Thursdays through Sundays from 7 a.m. to 2 p.m. if you'd like to stop by. You can visit them on Facebook, and if you'd like to make a donation to keep a little piece of East County's history alive, you can do so at the Help Major's Diner page on GoFundMe.com. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
At the start of the COVID-19 pandemic in March 2020, the Trump administration began expelling migrants without access to asylum hearings under Title 42. Now, after lifting most other pandemic mandates, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control has announced that suspending migrants' rights is no longer necessary due to the current public health conditions, as well as increased availability of vaccines and treatments. The action comes after Ukrainian and Russian refugees began turning up at the U.S.-Mexico international border, fleeing the war in Ukraine and persecution in Russia. But the policy will apply to all migrants seeking asylum. Title 42 was used to expel over 1.7 million migrants in the past 2 years, Associated Press reports. Title 42 will be lifted starting May 23rd. After that, the Border Patrol will go back to processing anyone found crossing the border, as it always has in the past, a Border Patrol official told Voice of America. So a migrant who crosses the border between points of entry illegally can still be removed without access to an immigration court. But if migrants arrive at the border and claim asylum, they will be interviewed by an asylum officer. If the migrant passes a credible fear screening due to dangers in their homeland that they've fled from, the migrants will be allowed a hearing in immigration court. If their claims are found not credible, they can be deported, but if asylum is granted, they can stay in the U.S. Ed Cifuentes with the American Civil Liberties Union, or ACLU Foundation of San Diego and Imperial Counties, praised the action. He says, under the guise of public health, the policy has unlawfully stripped people fleeing from danger of the right to seek asylum by expelling them without due process. Congressman Juan Vargas a Democrat who represents San Diego's border areas, calls the change a welcome step and says, Title 42 was never about public health and safety. It was implemented to deny due process to people seeking refuge and protection, Times of San Diego reports. But Congressman Dial Issa, a Republican, disagrees. He calls the action a reckless decision that he believes would cause a flood of additional illegal immigrants. Several Republicans in Congress have sought to tie any lifting of Title 42 to first ending the national COVID-19 public health emergency declaration, then notifying Congress and waiting an additional 60 days for any rollback. While lifting Title 42 would restore rights of asylum seekers with credible fear claims to have court hearings to potentially be granted asylum, it would also make it riskier for migrants who try to cross the border illegally. Title 42 lifted legal consequences for migrants crossing between border stations by allowing expulsion without other consequences. But ironically, with legal channels to seek asylum blocked for many during the past 2 years, Title 42 has resulted in a 30% increase in repeated border crossings, according to U.S. Customs and Patrol data, Voice of America reports. Congressman Vargas says the Biden administration has a plan ready to manage the border policy changes. He says he looks forward to working with federal agencies, local governments, and nonprofits to ensure migrants seeking refuge in our country are given the due process they deserve. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Tidwell.
An annual list of best and worst produce in terms of pesticide residue is out, and strawberries, spinach, kale, and collard and mustard greens top the list. The 2022 Dirty Dozen from the Environmental Working Group also includes nectarines, apples, grapes, peppers, cherries, peaches, pears, celery, and tomatoes. Sydney Swanson with EWG says the data comes from the U.S. Department of Agriculture based on 45,000 produce samples.
This year, we did find that over 70% of conventional produce sold in the United States was contaminated with pesticides. While everything tested was within legal limits, we believe that legal does not mean safe.
Farmers say they only apply pesticides approved by the feds. EWG says people should still eat lots of fruits and vegetables, but recommends they choose organic produce. Last year, the Biden administration reinstated an Obama-era ban on the notorious pesticide chlorpyrifos, a ban that was lifted during the Trump years. Swanson says people should wash all fruits and vegetables, but notes the USDA also washes the produce samples before testing them.
The USDA washes them and prepares them the exact same way that a consumer would prepare them at home, and they test it that way. So the pesticide residues that we would be exposed to is the same amount that the USDA is detecting.
The group also publishes a list of produce it calls the Clean 15, on which almost 70% of samples had no detectable pesticide residues. That list includes, starting with the cleanest, avocados, sweet corn, pineapple, onions, papaya, frozen sweet peas, asparagus, honeydew, kiwis, cabbage, mushrooms, cantaloupe, mangoes, watermelon, and sweet potatoes. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
This is Marie Johnson with a public service announcement from the San Diego County Library System. There's good news for book lovers, scholars, and other library users. During the pandemic, local libraries cut back on their hours, but now all of San Diego County's 33 community branch libraries are expanding their hours starting April 11th. The 6 largest county libraries will now be open 7 days a week. That includes the branch libraries in El Cajon, Encinitas, La Mesa, Poway, San Marcos, and Vista. All 33 branches will also include evening hours. The new hours are posted on signs at each of the libraries and can be found online at the San Diego County Library's website at sdcl.org.
This is East County Magazine's Crime Beat. On the streets, reporting on crimes impacting communities across our region, helping to keep you safe and informed.
Law enforcement agencies will no longer be investigating themselves when an officer-involved shooting occurs, starting May 1st. Recognizing the need for transparent and independent investigations of officer and deputy-involved shootings, members of the San Diego County Chiefs and Sheriffs Association have signed a Memorandum of Understanding which establishes a new countywide protocol for investigations of officer and deputy-involved shootings. The top law enforcement officers aim to build public trust by ensuring that no agencies investigate their own shooting incidents. The announcement came at a press conference on April 13th with Undersheriff Kelly Martinez, San Diego Police Chief David Nislett, Chula Vista Police Chief Roxana Kennedy, and District Attorney Summer Stephen. All police departments in San Diego County have signed the agreement, including all local police departments as well as police departments of San Diego State, the University of California, Harbor Police, and the Sheriff's Department, as well as the County Probation Department. The Sheriff's Department will investigate shootings involving San Diego Police Department. The San Diego Police Department will investigate shootings involving sheriff's deputies, as well as those involving other local law enforcement agencies, such as El Cajon and the La Mesa Police in East County. If a shooting involves both the Sheriff's Department and the San Diego Police, then the Chula Vista Police Department will handle the investigation. The San Diego County District Attorney's Office will continue to review all shootings once the investigation by the primary investigative agency is completed. Undersheriff Kelly Martinez calls the change an important and fundamental shift to assure that investigators are independent and unbiased. She adds, "We are proud to be part of this new agreement with our partner law enforcement agencies and to provide accurate information about these incidents by instilling trust between our agencies and the communities we serve." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Tidwell.
San Diego County is one of seven California counties participating in CalScope. That's a study that will help public health professionals better understand how many people in California have antibodies against COVID-19. The state's Department of Public Health has randomly selected about 45,000 San Diego households to participate in this study. If your household was selected, you should have received or be receiving an invitation with a unique access code to sign up online or over the phone. You'll be asked to complete an anonymous survey and a free at-home COVID-19 antibody test using a finger prick blood sample. Each participant will receive a gift card for completing the survey and another one for returning the blood test sample. The study will help the state and local health departments monitor the COVID-19 pandemic and refine strategies to protect the health of Californians. For more information about CalScope, you can visit the study website at calscope.org. This has been a public service announcement for the County of San Diego and the California Department of Public Health. The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Miriam Raftery with a Green Scene Report. Opponents of wind farms in San Diego's rural East County have long voiced concerns over potentially deadly impacts on local eagles. Now, a major wind energy company, NextEra Energy, a subsidiary of ESI Energy, has pleaded guilty to violating the Migratory Bird Treaty Act and killing 150 eagles at multiple wind energy facilities. The company was ordered to pay over $8 million in fines and restitution for violations at wind farms in Wyoming and New Mexico. but also acknowledged deaths of bald and golden eagles at 50 other wind farms in 8 states since 2012. Despite this slaughter of our nation's national symbol by wind turbine blades, the company was sentenced only to probation, no prison time for any of its officials, despite flagrant violations of federal law. The company has since pledged to shut off turbines when eagles are most apt to be present and to pay over $29,000 for each eagle killed in the future. Now, if NextEra sounds familiar, it's because it's the same company building a solar energy facility in Hecumbe Hot Springs locally. But several other wind energy companies that have built or hope to build wind projects in East County have relied largely on surveys done by the late David Bittner, which concluded the projects would not threaten eagles. However, Bittner was paid by the wind energy companies, and shortly after the studies locally were done, he was convicted in federal court on charges of mishandling protected birds. He operated without licenses for years, it turns out. He refused to turn over tracking data on protected species to federal wildlife officials and was found to have 4 freezers full of dead birds kept illegally, including protected raptors. Donna Tisdale, chair of the Boulevard Planning Group, has been battling wind farms locally for years. Asked her reaction to news of NextEra's guilty plea, she told us, "The death toll of eagles, raptors, songbirds, and bats from massive wind turbines is a sad commentary on the forced transition to allegedly clean wind and solar. Turbine blades can churn at 120 to 190 miles an hour," she says. "That death toll can only increase with the planned decarbonization climate change goals that will require quadrupling the installation rate of industrial wind and solar projects in California and the nation." Tisdale adds that 2 to 4 new 100-megawatt wind and solar projects, each covering hundreds to thousands of acres, will be required annually to meet these goals. The American Eagle Foundation and American Bird Conservancy estimate that over 1.4 million birds will be killed by 2030 if there is no change in U.S. policy toward wind energy projects. Nearly a decade ago, a 2013 study found wind turbines were killing over 500,000 birds each year in the United States, and many more facilities have been built since then. The notorious Altamont Wind Resource Area in Northern California alone killed over 2,000 golden eagles, and deaths have continued even after mitigation efforts. Recently, the National Audubon Society filed a lawsuit in Alameda seeking to prevent approval of a wind project. It noted that Altamont is back on pace to kill as many golden eagles as it did 15 years ago, according to Glenn Phillips, executive director of the Golden State Audubon Society. The late Dr. Michael Hutchins, former national coordinator of the American Bird Conservancy's Bird Smart Wind Energy campaign, has said, "Alternative energy is not green if it is killing hundreds or thousands or millions of birds annually. Our wildlife should not be collateral damage in our effort to combat climate change, nor does it have to be," he said. Wildlife advocates have called for improved regulations and following science to require proper siting and mitigation of any wind farms built. But the wind industry has a long history of ignoring federal laws to protect eagles and making pledges for mitigation that have proven ineffective in many areas, raising concerns that San Diego's small number of golden and bald eagles could be devastated as more and more wind projects gain approval.
We're on the road in East County, visiting some amazing towns and meeting some incredible people across our region. Welcome to another adventure on East County Magazine's On the Road.
A fun place to visit in El Cajon is the Water Conservation Garden. Located on the Cuyamaca College campus, this garden is fully surrounded with flowers, plants, ponds, wildlife, and educational interactives. It's a place for both children and adults to enjoy and learn about water-wise gardening, fire-resistant landscaping, native plants, and vegetable gardens.
The garden is a flutter, a flurry of activities. We have workshops here of every kind about your landscape, about making cheese, crafting classes.
Not only is this park a great place to visit, but it has an important mission behind its purpose. Director of Operations and Programs Pam Meisner emphasized the focus of the garden is to educate on eco-friendly and efficient gardening. Miss Smarty Plants is one of the workshop programs she runs for kids.
I think the best part about being Miss Smarty Plants is that I get to see the innocence, the wonder of a child every day. I truly believe in my heart of hearts, our youth is going to save the earth.
The garden offers field trips for kids, yoga classes, and other events depending on the season, but is also a pleasant and relaxing place to walk amid a beautiful environment.
Once you know it's here and once you come here, you don't have to sell the garden. It sells itself.
Because this is a nonprofit organization, the garden's finances took a hit, causing it to require a submission fee for entry as opposed to being free.
We used to be a totally free garden. We used to be totally free. We changed to an admissions model in June when we were able to open back up.
The Water Conservation Garden is open Tuesday to Sunday, 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. and open until 6 p.m. on Thursdays. For more information about the exciting and enjoyable things the Water Conservation Garden has to offer, visit the website at thegarden.org.
Miss Smarty Plant's mantra is, we can change the world with our own two hands.
And for East County Magazine, I'm Angela Kurish.
Welcome. This is Mimi Pollack, host of East County Magazine's Animal Tales. Welcome to Animal Tales. This is Mimi Pollack. I am here today with Ramona wildlife photographer Roy Tuft. Not only is he a renowned photographer with pictures appearing in National Geographic magazine, he also offers guided tours to Africa, Costa Rica, and Alaska. Tuft got his degree as a wildlife biologist, so the focus of these tours is showing you how to photograph indigenous wildlife while having adventures in the wild. Welcome, Roy.
Thanks for having me, Mimi. Happy to be here.
How did you get into wildlife photography?
Well, I was the crazy kid in Poway with the garage full of snakes, right? So right away, everybody knew I loved animals. And so I grew up loving animals, getting out in our local chaparral and watching the hawks and catching snakes and enjoying that. Went on to get a wildlife degree from Cal Poly San Luis Obispo in Northern California and got my first camera as I graduated from college and started taking pictures of what I loved.
What type of camera was it?
It was a Canon AE-1, which was kind of a classic old film camera.
And so the camera inspired you to start taking pictures and combining both the wildlife degree along with the photography?
Yeah, I mean, it's always the animals that were the major interest, and the photography is kind of a stimulus to get you out there, right? And it keeps you out there longer. So it's just kind of a natural thing to want to enjoy your subjects more. You can take images of them and enjoy them when you're back home.
And besides Costa Rica and Alaska, what countries have you been to in Africa, and what other countries have you been to in the world where you've done wildlife photography?
Wow, good question. I've been to, I should count the number of countries I've been to, but in the last 30 years of doing wildlife photography, I've been pretty much all over the world, from Antarctica to Japan and Indonesia and Australia, New Zealand, most of the countries in Africa and Central and South America. So yeah, I guess it'd be easier to say very few places I haven't been at this point.
And after college, how did you move into becoming more of a professional wildlife photographer?
Well, right after college, I started working at the Wild Animal Park here in San Diego. I guess now it's called the Zufari Park, which is always hard for me to remember. And I was doing the bird show there, and it's kind of a, I think anybody that's been in San Diego for a while knows that bird show. It's been there for 30 years, so I was happy that they asked me to join them there at the bird show. And being at the Wild Animal Park every day, doing my job at the bird show, of course, I'm surrounded by beautiful wildlife, even though it's, you know, it's not really wild, but it gave me an opportunity to get out during breaks and lunch hours with my camera and start taking imagery and work on it and get better at it. And so that really got me going into wildlife photography.
And how did you get connected to National Geographic magazine?
One of my last years working at the park, we had a National Geographic photographer come to the park doing a story on new zoos. And his name was Michael Nick Nichols, really a world-renowned photographer who's done dozens and dozens of stories for National Geographic. Well, everybody at the park knew I was into photography pretty heavily at that point. So they asked Nick if he needed an assistant, and I helped him on that new zoos project. So that kind of got me, you know, a little bit in working with National Geographic. And a couple years later, I went and did a 2-year project with Nick on tigers that we spent 2 years photographing wild tigers. And that was kind of the start of my career and a wonderful, you know, mentorship for me to be working with such a well-known and terrific photographer as Nick.
Okay. Tell me more about those 2 years photographing tigers. For example, what exactly did you do while you were there? How did you help Nick? And do you have any memorable moment or story that you can tell us from those years?
Sure. Yeah. So we are working in India, which has the largest population of tigers. And a big part of the story, of course, is doing a natural history portion of the project. So we spent over 2 years photographing a female tiger raising cubs. And so we basically go out every day at 4:30 in the morning on elephant back, because that's the easiest and most accessible way to be close to tigers, is to be on top of an animal that they're not really that nervous about. 7 days a week for 3 months per trip to India. So we did three of those for the natural history portion. And we were photographing tigers, and we'd spend about 10 hours a day in the field and only see tigers about every 5 days on average. So it was a lot of time in the field for very little, you know, return, but it was definitely worth it.
But didn't you also do some groundbreaking work with remote cameras?
Yes, Nick was just really pushing the limits with remote cameras in the field, and tigers being a difficult animal to photograph in person and at close range. He set up 7 remote cameras in the jungle with my help, and my main job was to keep those remote cameras running 24/7. A remote camera, if you don't know, is a system where there's an infrared beam, and the animal basically breaks that beam and takes his own picture. And that allowed us to take wide-angle, very intimate shots of tigers that have never been done before. And that was one of our main ways of getting that kind of unique imagery of tigers while we were there.
That sounds very interesting. I imagine you must have gotten some incredible photographs with the remote cameras. Is there any one particular picture that you remember that comes to mind? Or
yeah, actually, and just for the listeners at home, if you have kind of that stack of National Geographic magazines on your library wall, it's 1997 December is the cover issue, and one of the pictures in there was a 50-page story, so it was a huge Nat Geo article. One of the pictures, I placed a camera on a vertical dry waterfall, so it's a rock wall. And we had seen a male tiger jump that chasm in where the water would be running if it was actually wet, and to get to another water source. And so we put this camera, set it up so he's jumping right into a 20-millimeter wide lens, which is a very unique perspective. And that camera was there for 3 months, and we had one picture from that 3 months, and it's in the issue, and it's amazing, you know, a male tiger jumping right into the camera midair. So it's one of those, you know, pictures you'd never get in person. You'd have to kind of use this system of remote cameras. And it's much more common nowadays. But when Nick did it and we did it for the Tiger Project, it was really revolutionary.
I remember that issue. It's just amazing. Now tell me about a memorable moment.
Another memorable moment with tigers is, as I mentioned earlier, we spent a lot of time in elephants following tigers and photographing them, you know, straight and not with a remote camera. Well, at one time, Nick was on one elephant, I was on another elephant, and we have our mahouts, or our drivers, driving the elephants, and we had this one male tiger named Charger that was in this tall grass, and we backed our elephants into the grass to be able to photograph from a perspective down into the grass, and obviously went too close to the tiger as he was feeling pressured. He came up on the back of Nick's elephant. Actually jumped onto the rear of the elephant.
Wow.
Which was exciting for everyone, especially the elephants. So the elephants just started spinning and screaming, and we, you know, Nick and I held on for dear life,
and they rotated fast.
Yes, they just spun, you know, just like tornadoes, and just sent the tiger flying, and it was quite an exciting moment. You know, like most things with wildlife photography, when instances like this happen, you know, it's usually because we do something wrong, and it was obviously our fault. We pushed we asked the elephants to get too close to the tiger, and he just did what was natural for a tiger, which is, you know, get out of here. And of course, he did it in a very traumatic fashion.
That was probably scary and exciting at the same time.
Yeah, certainly.
And then after, when you finished with doing the tiger shoot, what was the next project you worked on?
Well, after the tiger project, I came home and rested for a while because that was a long project. I actually did an assignment for Audubon Magazine where I went and photographed ocelots in Texas. And it's another cat, a smaller spotted cat. And a lot of people don't know we have ocelots in the United States.
I didn't know that. Ocelots in Texas. What part of Texas?
Yeah, this was in near Laguna Atascosa, so it's way south Texas. The majority of ocelots are found in Central and South America, so this is just kind of a small population coming up into Texas.
Are they endangered?
They are endangered. There's only about 50 ocelots left in Texas in the United States. And so, yeah, I was also using remote cameras again to photograph this elusive cat.
And then what was your next big shoot after that?
Wow. Next big shoot after that. I did a project for another project for Audubon on a rainforest photography and birds. So that was another cover story for Audubon magazine.
I remember you told me about wolves, that you did something up in Alaska with wolves.
Yeah, you know, right out of college, as I mentioned, I was a wildlife biology major. And right out of college, I did a wolf population study up in Alaska for the summer. It was, you know, merely a three-month project putting collars on wolves so we could do a population study. So that was my first time in the field with my new camera. So that was a kind of an exciting time for me.
And then also for, like, I believe it was 3 years, you and your wife opened up a gallery up in Solana Beach on Cedros Avenue, right?
Yeah, we had a beautiful gallery on Cedros in Solana Beach, and it was my wife's idea to kind of show my art to people and be able to have a gallery. And we, it was fun. We did that and met a lot of local people. It was when we first moved back to San Diego in the early 2000s. You know, we moved back in 2005.
Where did you live before then?
We were up in the Bay Area for about 8 years, up in Half Moon Bay on the coast south of San Francisco.
But you are a local San Diego boy, right? Where did you grow up?
Yeah, I actually grew up in Poway. So we moved to Poway in 1970. Yeah, I grew up here, went to high school here, went off to college in Northern California, and then we moved around a bit and then came back to kind of the motherland here in Ramona in 2005.
What do you like about living in Ramona?
We love the wilderness experience we have in Ramona. You know, we live on big acreage, which you can still find here in the East County, which is great. And so it's peaceful.
How many acres?
We have 40 acres.
Wow.
Yeah, and
nice.
It's in kind of the big boulder country up there near Mount Woodson, so it's beautiful. Lots of local wildlife. You know, I don't always have to jump on an airplane to get my camera out and photograph wildlife. In fact, this last week, I've spent every morning in a blind photographing our small indigenous fox, our California gray fox, something that actually I've spent no time photographing fox all my years here. They're kind of a tough animal to see. We often see coyotes a lot more, but this is a little bit smaller canid that is more nocturnal, quite a bit more elusive than coyotes. And they're just beautiful. They have a gray color with a cinnamon rust on the chest and their shoulders. Gorgeous, big, fluffy tail. And this week I was sitting in a blind photographing a den with five kits, and that's what they call young foxes. So what a great, you know, here I am in my backyard. I got my coffee and I walk across the valley, get in my blind and photograph beautiful foxes right here in San Diego County.
I know, I've seen the pictures. They're amazing. Now, you mentioned to me earlier that you have a teaching credential and you enjoy working with people. And so you mentioned to me that in the year 2000, you started organizing photographic expeditions where you would take people to different countries and teach them how to photograph wildlife. Tell us more about that.
Sure. Yeah, that's a big part of my business now is leading photographic tours or safaris. And, you know, it's never a better time than now to take photos. You know, the digital era and digital cameras have made it so much more accessible for people. You know, you're not spending a ton of money on film. You know, you're getting instant feedback from these little TV screens. So you can really progress much quicker than the old days with film. And so, you know, people are finding they want to go out instead of going on a typical vacation and going to some beach and sitting on the beach or going golfing, that there's this whole other avenue for vacations. And, you know, you can combine wildlife viewing, traveling, and learning, you know, something new and exciting. And that's what I do in these wildlife tours. You know, I bring people to Africa or Brazil or Alaska for bears or Mexico, and Costa Rica is one of my all-time favorite destinations. It's close and you have a rainforest right there. So it's a wonderful way to get people out in the field and, you know, try out a new camera, or if they're already an experienced photographer, it's wonderful to go with a pro that already gives you, taking you to the best spots and the best lodges. And so that's a big part of my business. In fact, this year I'll be in the field 160 days running my photo tours.
For those of you who just tuned in, this is KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso, East County Magazine. Now, I want to go into more detail about these trips. For example, what countries do you go to in Africa?
My main country I go to in Africa is Botswana, a lovely country. It's just north of South Africa, so it's in the southern part of the continent. And I've been going there. This will be my 14th year leading tours to Botswana, so obviously I love it. It's spectacular wildlife. Most people perhaps have heard of the Okavango Delta, which is a very well-known area. It's a floodplain and a desert that creates this oasis for wildlife. And so that's my main destination. Although I have to say next week, I'm going to Tanzania in East Africa, leading a photo trip there. So a couple different countries in Africa I go to.
Getting back to Botswana, do some people go there because of the books, the number one ladies detective agency? Do they ever go there and ask you about that? Or?
Yeah, you know, it's funny you mentioned that. I mean, we people who go to Botswana, of course, have read those books because it's such an interesting series and it's based in Botswana. I don't think it's the reason they go, obviously, because it's really the wildlife that brings them there. But it's a nice connection.
Yeah. And when people go to Africa, they must think that, you know, they're going to be roughing it. Or why don't you tell us, because I remember you mentioned to me that you want people to know that going to Africa is not going to be roughing it, that it's actually going to be a very pleasant experience in terms of lodging and food and how they take care of you. Why don't you tell us more about that?
Yeah, I mean, I get that a lot, Mimi. I get, you know, isn't it dangerous and aren't you afraid going to Africa? And I think so much of the media reports of, you know, they generalize when they're speaking of the entire continent of Africa, when there's, you know, there's epidemics of something going on or a little bit of violence somewhere. It's a huge continent. And, you know, we're going to a place that's very safe. In fact, the most dangerous part of your African safari will be driving to the airport here in Limburg Field. I mean, being in your car statistically is more dangerous than any other part of the trip. And we're taken care of. It's just really amazing the service level that we get on in our trips to Africa, the lodging, the food, the wine. Yeah, everything is five star. So there's absolutely no roughing it. You know, I have clients that are kind of wonder what big hiking boots they should buy to bring on my trip. And I have to tell them that, you know, I wear Crocs, the most comfortable light slip-on shoe, because we're in vehicles all day. We're not going on death marches. We're not hiking. We're driving around in wonderful vehicles and viewing this wildlife very close and photographing it and then going back for wonderful dinners and wonderful lodging. So it's, you know, it's nothing that you have to worry about roughing it. It's very much a luxury vacation.
I've also heard that the African people themselves are very friendly and very welcoming.
They really are. They are just over the top friendly, just smiles from ear to ear at all times. And so it's a wonderful cultural experience. People that just don't get to travel that much, if it's based on fear, get out there and see some other places around the world, because people are people. And when you go to these communities, they're just so welcoming. And, you know, it's such a joy to see people from around the world and get a different perspective. If you're just always in one location, it's tough to view the world in more than one perspective. So yeah, get out there and travel and see the world and see some beautiful places. That's what I like to do.
Now, what about for the more outdoorsy types, the ones that want to go hiking, the ones that want to have more of an outdoor adventure? What country would you recommend that they take a photographic tour with you, but to where? Like, for somebody who's more of an outdoorsy hiking.
Yeah, if you don't want to be in a vehicle the entire time and you want to get out and physically, you know, hike and enjoy the environment. I actually have several that do that. Costa Rica is a great one. It's close. It's an easy flight. Within 6 hours, you're in prime rainforest and seeing, you know, four species of monkeys and tropical birds, toucans and parrots. It's really mind-boggling, you know, in this day and age. You can just get away for 6-8 hours and you're in this amazing tropical environment. So that's one we definitely get out and hike and experience that rainforest. As I mentioned earlier, I was just in Chile photographing pumas, our mountain lion, same cat. And it's possible there to photograph them on foot. And so we do a lot of hiking in Torres de Peña National Park in Chile. So that's definitely high up. People really want to get their heart rate up and do some hiking along with photography and wildlife viewing. Then that's a great destination.
And now what about Alaska? Tell us what about your tours to Alaska.
Well, Alaska is another location that's close and easy to get to. And, you know, we have our own Serengeti right here in the United States, and that is Alaska. So there's nothing like the open spaces up there. I've been leading bear trips up there for over 10 years. And so this is a brown bear excursion where we're out, you know, on foot, hiking and photographing the feeding brown bears. They're feeding on salmon in August on the different rivers in Alaska. So it's another thrilling, large carnivore photography adventure. But once again, we're staying on a boat and it's amazing food and, you know, catching our own halibut and king crab and not much roughing it there either. I guess I'm getting older, Mimi, so I don't want to rough it either. So I like to go to destinations that we can, you know, have a nice place to stay and good food and enjoy each other's company and still get out and see wildlife.
Well, you're definitely a people person, so I can see how you would have fun leading these tours. For those of you who just tuned in, this is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, East County Magazine, and this is Mimi Pollack, and I'm talking to wildlife photographer Roy Tuft. Now, what would you say for when you take your people on these tours to Africa, Costa Rica, Alaska, Chile? Tell me two tips to be able to do successful wildlife photography.
Two tips. I think the first thing is patience. When we go out with wildlife, it's not like going to a studio or going to the zoo or where things are just going to perform for you. So I really, you know, I have to set expectations for my clients that we're going to extremely rich areas for wildlife, but there's still an element of being patient. The animals aren't there to please you or entertain you. We're just going in their environment. And obviously I'm taking people to very productive areas where we're going to see some great stuff. But, you know, just be happy to be there. And, you know, and that's my job is to get you in the right spot at the right time and to have wonderful wilderness experiences.
Nice. Is there a website people can go to find out more information?
Sure. My website is toftphoto.com. So my last name, T-O-F as in Frank, T, photo, P-H-O-T-O.com. And, you know, you can get on there. I have lots of different links to photography and wildlife. I actually have a tours and workshops page. So you want to get on there to see where I'm going, what I'm doing, and feel free to shoot me an email.
All right. Well, thank you very much. And if you would like more information about Roy, look for my article that's coming up in East County Magazine. This is Mimi Pollack of Animal Tales. Thank you very much.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia, and the Smashing Beats. Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jewel, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show, or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine radio show.